As I said, we've been working through John's Gospel, the first 18 verses, this Christmas month to explore why God became a man. It's impossible to separate the fact of Jesus becoming man without also explaining the purpose for his arrival. And as much as I enjoy Christmas traditions, and I most certainly do enjoy Christmas traditions, it is good for us to slow down and think of some Christmas truth that God became human on purpose. And John wants to help us to understand why this morning. And so with that, let's take a look again at verses 14 and 15. We just read it, but I want to read it again because I often think that when we first read it, we're not really hearing it. Sometimes we need to read the word two or three times. Whenever I'm in a study with a group of folks, I tend to slow down and go, okay, now somebody else read it. Now somebody else read it. And it's by about the third or fourth time that you actually hear God speaking to you. And so I want to read it to you again. It says this in verses 14 and 15. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, this was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he was before me. What a strange thing for John to say. He who comes after me, because John is 6 months older than Jesus, ranks before me because he was before me. He is pointing us to the deity of Jesus having existed from all eternity. This is what John is saying. Now, it's fascinating for us as Christians because we know that the incarnation stands out as one of the great mysteries of our faith. There's nothing like it. To think that the all-powerful, all-knowing, ever-present, infinite God, the God of the universe that made it all, would enter in this world in humility, being subject to time and space, is utterly unique amongst the world's religions. For the Jews, as we've been saying, this truth, this incarnation truth, was loaded with theological confusion for them. The Jews couldn't grasp that God would come in the flesh in this way, and the reason why is they were struggling to understand and reconcile texts that on the one hand spoke of God's coming king in splendor and glory, and yet on the other hand there seemed to be hints of a Messiah coming in humility and through suffering. For the Greeks, we know that for them, the material world was something to be escaped, not something to be embraced and redeemed. For them, they would ask the question, why in the world would the central power and force behind everything take on the filth of materiality? And John says that not only did the Word become flesh, but he uses a strange word. He says that he dwelt among us. And the word for dwelt is actually the word tabernacle. Another way that we could put it is that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. That he pitched a tent in our midst. And why would John use such a word? Why would he consider Jesus coming in the flesh a tabernacle event? Well, to understand that, you have to go back to the book of Exodus and understand a little bit of the tabernacle. In the book of Exodus, the tabernacle is a major theme. And unless you understand its significance in that book, you'll never understand the book, and you certainly won't understand what John is referencing. Why? Because in Exodus, it's a story that begins with slavery, and it ends in worship. The story that begins in slavery and ends in worship, and that's the point. It starts with a suffering and disparate people, and it ends with God's presence and glory filling the tabernacle that is in the center of their camp where God's people could gather round and draw near him. It's kind of a micro story of our own lives, isn't it? Where we also have been burdened with sin, and in many ways we began prior to knowing Christ distant from him, not a people who love him, know him, follow him, in slavery in many ways, and then as we come to know him, as we draw near to him, more appropriately as he's drawn near to us, we become a people of worship and gratitude and thanks. But why do we need a tabernacle? Why in the world is John calling Jesus a tabernacle? Well, the tabernacle was the place where eternity touched earth. It's where transcendence touched time, where God's glory became grounded. And cultures for centuries have sought to bridge this gap between humanity and the divine. History repeats this story again and again. If any of you have done any work on sociology and specifically religion, you'll know that cultures around the world for almost all of human history have struggled to understand how they could bridge that barrier, that gap between the divine and humanity, between people and the transcendent. And that's why temples and tabernacles were constructed. They were constructed to be a kind of doorway from this world into the next. And it's only until very recently in our human history that there has been arguments made that there is no such thing as the divine, no transcendence on the other side. Everything we think is explainable through telescopes and microscopes, as helpful as they are. That is a very limited understanding of what it means to know, to have knowledge. But in these arguments, we protest what is being declared this morning by saying that we don't need temples and we don't need transcendence. After all you see is all we have, and it's all we'll ever need, and it's all you'll ever get. And yet, as much as we in our Western culture peddle this dogma, people don't buy it. It is fascinating to me that even in Europe, there is still a strong remnant that believes in God. Now, whatever that looks like and in whatever way that gets worked out, there is still this sense of awe surrounding the idea of transcendence, of there being something more than just this material world. And I think there's a reason for it. It's because in us is a sense of being built for something more than just what we see. We intuitively know that we're more than just a random collocation of atoms. We're more than just fizzing chemicals. We're more than just a bag of bones, more than just mechanized meat. And we know it no matter how much we try to avoid it. Because at the core, we are built for our builder. We are creatures made for our creator. And when he isn't the center, we disintegrate. He's what keeps us together, and he's what makes us whole. And without him, we don't function properly. And we're no good to this world and to ourselves and to others. There's a well-known philosopher who I enjoy. His name is Alasdair MacIntyre, and he raises the question. It's a good question. How do you know if a thing is good or not? How do you know if a thing is good or not? And he goes on to say, his answer is, that you know if a thing is good or not, whether or not the thing works according to its function and purpose. A thing is good or not, whether or not it works according to its function and purpose. And he uses a watch as an example. He says, you know a watch is good if it keeps time, and it keeps time accurately. But if you tried to take a watch and hammer nails, it would cease to be a good watch because it wouldn't function properly. It's not built for that. And in the same way, we humans are built for God. And without him, we don't function well. We don't work well. And that's why we need a tabernacle. We need a meeting place between us and God. So instead of living our lives as poor excuses for hammers, we can begin to live as free worshipers, just as God intended from the very beginning. So how does a tabernacle work? Well, the tabernacle functioned as a kind of doorway between us and God. In the Old Testament, it was a frightening and inviting place. It was frightening because God is holy. He's not safe, and we are unholy, and we are impure. And it is inviting because our entire being is magnetically drawn to his presence. But the problem remains, how in the world does what is unholy and unclean enter the presence of what is infinitely holy and pure? The tabernacle was constructed to deal with this very problem. God, for the Israelites, lovingly provided a way for them to come near to him. By bringing his presence and glory to them, even if it was only temporarily through the tabernacle. And for some of you, this might just sound like mystical nonsense. And I think in large part, the reason why you might reject this idea is because for you, if there was any God, if there was anything transcendent, you should be able to walk in and have a relationship with it on your own terms. The idea that somehow God's presence and glory was something that not only magnetically drew us to him, but something that we feared because it revealed our impurities sounds odd. And I think there's two reasons for that. One, it's because we think we're pretty awesome. And so we don't understand glory and holiness. Or two, it's because we've so lowered God's holiness and glory to that which is attainable for us that it's no longer traumatic to us. It's no longer something that causes our bones to shake. Well, the tabernacle was that thin space. A thin space between God's presence and glory and humanity, where humanity could draw close in worship. But it was only a temporary place. And as much as it might sound strange to think of a thin space like that, where there's something holy and other, the fact of the matter is, we still have thin spaces. Now, it may not be the divine and his glory that we're going after, but we all know that there's places and times and events that we can't just saunter into any which way we want, right? We know this culturally. My daughter was just married to Caleb, her new husband, her only husband, sounding new as if she had a series of them. She was married in July, and if one of my friends would have shown up in a ripped up, pizza stained Motley Crue t-shirt and cargo shorts that were filthy and flip-flops, I'd have probably been doing prison ministry from the inside. That would not have gone over well. Why? Because it's my daughter's big day. You don't just show up her wedding like that. That's no. You are going to get the right hand of fellowship, brother. You don't show up at my daughter's wedding. And maybe not weddings. Maybe it's funerals. We know at funerals, you don't just go to a funeral in your pajamas. I mean, unless you're the one in the box, but you wouldn't do that. Who would do that? And we know that there are certain events or certain times or certain spaces that are reserved. They're set aside. I mean, there's even restaurants that we wouldn't saunter into. Can you imagine going to Killian's, like in your yard work clothes, all funky and stanky, and then expect to be sat and welcomed? Probably not. Maybe Ruth's Chris. Maybe you don't like Killian's. Is it Killian's or is it Killin's? I couldn't hear you, so I'm just going to go with Killian's. I mean, you got to get cleaned. You got to be fitted for the place, right? There are just certain things that we need to be fit for. In fact, there are certain groups that we long and desire to get into. Right? Maybe they carry some social capital or power. Maybe they help us educationally, or maybe they're a group of folks that are power brokers at our workplace, the executives of the company, and we want to get into that inner circle. And so we change. We get weird, don't we? Around people that are powerful, they have something that we want or we need their respect and admiration, we get all weird, get all stuffy and constipated and upright, you know, kind of like that. And we speak like we don't normally speak, and we use words that we don't know the meanings to, and we brush our teeth finely, you know, and arrange our last remaining four hairs, and like we try to be presentable. Because that's a group, that's a holy group, it's a set aside group that we want to be in the inner circle. So look, there are people and there are places and spaces and events that we know are holy and set apart. And we as a culture go through this motion of making ourselves fit. So it isn't that crazy to think God, the maker of the universe, who has all power and is all beautiful and has all glory contained in himself, that there wouldn't be a desire for change, certainly at his meeting. He says in verse 14 that it's such a strange thing. We have seen his glory. We have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. We've seen his glory. We'll get to that in a minute. That is important. We've seen his glory. You see, for a Jewish worshiper, they would not have taken this verse and sentimentalized it by making a Hallmark movie with a crackling fire and hot chocolate with some marshmallows in it, as good as that sounds, you know, singing Christmas carols, jingle bells or something. Like, a Jew hearing this would have been gobsmacked. They would have been completely thunderstruck by such a declaration that we have seen his glory. To them, God's glory was dangerous. And whenever worshipers in the Old Testament heard about the glory of God coming down, they would have thought immediately of a couple of things. They would have thought of the raging inferno on Sinai, or they would have thought of Isaiah's vision in Isaiah 6, where just from the kind of presence of God, the effulgence of God being manifest, inanimate objects in the temple are shaking. They have the right mind and presence to shake in their place. So they would have considered that. They wouldn't have thought what we think. And like Moses, they longed to see the glory of God. And like Moses, God warned them that to do so would cost their life, because the weight and the radiance of God's glory makes his glory the most dangerous substance in the entire universe. And yet, in Jesus, John is saying, this glory is contained in flesh. Or as my friend Eric Mason says, God tucked his Shekinah in his skin suit and came to our hood. That's exactly what he did. He tucked his Shekinah in a skin suit and came to our hood. It's weird for me to say it that way, isn't it? You're a little troubled by that. So am I. I think it's a great saying. I just can't get away with it, apparently. Seeing Jesus means beholding God's glory. That's what it means. That's what John is trying to say. Seeing Jesus means beholding God's glory, because in Jesus, the fullness of grace and truth is found. And in Jesus, God's glory is revealed. Did you guys ever see the movie? This shows how old I am. Did you guys ever see the movie Cocoon? You know, with Bruce Danaher? I can't remember who the other, what's the other actor? No one cares. Okay. So great movie. It was about aliens, right? And these old folks that are in an old folks retirement home, this alien pod comes down and I think it drops in their pool and they're swimming and okay, and then they start to get rejuvenated. They start living young. Right, they have all this energy. They're revitalized, if you would. And then eventually, the character, Bruce Danaher's character, he's driving them. They're running away from the popo, the police, and they're on a boat. They're taken off, and Danaher does something really weird because they don't know he's an alien under that skin. And remember, he pulls down his eyelid, and like this beam of glory shoots out. That's kind of what's going on here. That in Jesus is contained the fullness of the glory of God. And if you get close and you pay attention, it just breaks out every now and again. That's what he's saying. Let's take a look at verses 16 and 17. We'll hear what John says. He says, For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. So he came to tabernacle among us, the Word, the eternal Word, the Logos was made flesh. He came to this earth. In him is glory. He's full of grace and truth. And from his fullness, we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. The law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. John's saying God's grace is just never used up. It's a never-ending well of grace. It's a never-emptying storehouse. You cannot out-sin God's grace. No matter what you've done or what you're doing or what you will do, you cannot out-sin God's grace. Now, there are some of you here that need to hear this because you struggle to understand God's love and acceptance of you, and you don't think that God loves and accepts you purely by grace, which is why you're still troubled and anxious and insecure about your righteousness. But I want you to know, this is going to hurt a little bit, I want you to know how utterly arrogant that is, because what you are saying is that your estimation of yourself trumps God's estimation of you. What you're saying is that somehow your sin is greater than the grace of God. Really? John's trying and searching and seeking for words to try to explain this. He's stacking up graces. Like, this is grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. And we receive it from him. Every day is grace. Every beat of our heart, grace. Every firing of our synapse, grace. It's all grace. You wake in God's grace and mercy every day. And this is all out of Jesus' fullness, contained in himself. And that's why grace is so important to John. Why? Because John is marveling at it. He is searching for words to explain it because of what he says next. He says that the law was given through Moses. Moses didn't create it. He didn't own it. It was something given to him. And God's law was the revelation of God's moral perfection, and it is the perfect standard by which every person on earth will be judged. His law tells us nothing about God's grace, his mercy, his love, or really any other attribute. His law shows us his moral perfection. You could say there is beauty in that, of course, but only if you're attracted to that, because otherwise it's repelling. And the law comes to condemn us. Did you know that? Why am I making this point? Because for those of you that are trying to keep up, that are overtired, overworked, over anxious, and over busy, that are trying to check every single Christian box that you can check to earn God's favor, you're under the law and the curse of it and the burden of it. The law can't grace us. The law condemns us. This is what Paul says in Romans 3:19. He says, listen carefully. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be stopped. All of our arguing, all of our little evil attorney rising up and saying, well, I don't like that. The law comes and shuts us up. You are not perfect. You're not as awesome as you think you are. And your holiness isn't that magnificent. And you are not someone, it's why we hate someone that wants to get glory for themselves. It's why we can't stand them. Because we know they're not worthy of our worship. And it's gross. God is the only one worthy of our worship because he is the only one whose glory is worth worshiping. It's a moral defect in us to long for and desire that kind of glory and worship, not for God, because it's who he is. And the only right response that we have would have towards God would be worship and praise. But the law can't get us there. The law stops our mouths. And he goes on to say, and the whole world may be held accountable to God. Every human that's ever lived is held accountable before God. And how is he held accountable? How is she held accountable? The law. The law. God's moral perfection. And yet the scriptures strangely teach in Psalm 19:7 that the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. What? Paul just argued that the law shuts our mouths and condemns us and holds the whole world guilty before God. And yet the psalmist says the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. How can that be? How can it be perfect to convert us? Paul makes this argument in Galatians 3. I know I'm jumping around a bit. Just go with me because I'm making an argument. And he makes this argument in Galatians 3:24 by saying, explaining the law, that the law is a tutor to lead us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. The law is literally a schoolmaster who grabs our hand and walks us over to the cross, to Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by faith. The law cannot save us, but the law can take us to Jesus. That's the purpose of the law. The law is to show us our need for Jesus. That's why the law was given. It's to reveal not only God's moral perfection, but it's to reveal our imperfection. It's to cause us to long for healing and cleansing. It's to cause us to long for grace. One of the reasons why I don't think the church is amazed anymore by the grace of God is because we don't believe this. No one will ever reach out for the grace of God unless they first recognize that they need it. If you think you're perfectly fine on your own, why in the world would you need Jesus? And in fact, sin is insulting to say that someone's a sinner. And the whole point of sending God's Son in the flesh for our sacrifice is nothing more than divine child abuse if we could save ourselves in our own awesomeness and our own holiness and glory. That's not what he's saying. He's saying the law was given for a good reason. It was given so that the law could hold us by the hand to take us to Jesus and we could be justified by faith, that we would see our need and we would go to the only solution for our sin. The law is a holy and perfect mirror. And just like a mirror shows us our filth, like if we have been working out in the garden all day long and we stand in front of the mirror before we go to bed, we're like, whoa, there's a lot there that I did not see. Why? Because you could not see. And the mirror is there to expose your blemishes and your imperfections. But only a complete knucklehead would take the mirror off the wall and try to scrub themselves. Right? We would get a jacket for that person. A tight jacket. And keep sharp objects from them. Because it makes no sense. The mirror's job is to show you your filth and then what you do responsively is you would turn on the water and you'd be cleansed, right? You'd be washed. And in the same way, God's law is a mirror for us. And it shows us our failure. And we need to see that. We need to hear that so that we would reach out for living water. And then grace becomes amazing and beautiful. And we grow as worshipers and become very thankful to God because we're rightly apprehending our state apart from him. We understand that by nature and choice, we have failed. We are sinners. There is no one righteous, no, not one. We have all turned aside. And when that reality comes home to you, you'll reach out in grace. And then all of a sudden, grace will be something that you enjoy. You know what else it'll do? Get you off the treadmill. There's something I'm concerned with about you Houstonians. You notice I said you, because I've only been here 2.5 months, so I think there's at least a 6-month probation. You might kick me out before then. Here's my big concern. After meeting every community group, and after sitting down one-on-one with every community group leader, I am deeply and profoundly concerned for your busyness. It's very strange. Being here and the time that I've been here, it's more like LA than it is San Diego and Seattle, where I've also lived. And no one moves to Seattle, you know, to like really accomplish a lot. It's because it's kind of hipster and cool and, you know, they got some good music and coffee and you can smoke legal weed there. And that's why people move to Seattle, right? Let's be honest. And San Diego, nobody moves to San Diego to like make it big. You moved to San Diego because it's San Diego. Why are you going to school in San Diego? Oh, they have an excellent program. No, they don't. You're going to San Diego because it's San Diego. That's the only reason why you're going there. But people don't move to Chicago for comfort. Nobody moves to New York for comfort. Nobody moves to LA for comfort. There's nothing comfortable about those cities. And in the same way, there's not really anything comfortable about Houston that would draw people. People come here for opportunity. And we live this life as perpetual oil diggers. It's like, I'm going to throw out 15 things, 15 ways. We're going to start digging in 15 ways, and maybe one or two will hit. You're overstretched. You have a life where the tail is wagging the dog, and you think you're making progress. You ain't going nowhere. It's like a hamster on a wheel, and then he just croaks, seizes, falls over. Gets pushed out of the way by another hamster. Another hamster jumps on, and they start doing the same thing. We're like, we're moving. You're not going anywhere. You're in a cage on a wheel, staying in place. That's what a life of busy is like. And you all know it. You know it. Aren't you tired of that life? Do you think this is what Jesus intended for us when he came to be our Sabbath? We would be so burdened and overworked that the call of Jesus to us as his people, for all that are laboring and heavy laden, to come to him because he will give us rest for our soul. How many of you need that? I do. And the thing about it is, I got to say it now because in 6 months, I will be assimilated. I will have gone through my conditioning classes. I will be enculturated and I won't see it anymore. And that scares me. I think the reason why we're busy is because we're trying to prove something that we don't believe we already have. We are not resting in God's approval for us, because that would reorient everything. If it is true that all grace and truth is found in Jesus and God loves us, not by our law keeping, but by his grace giving, then that absolutely changes everything. It has to. If it's true, it has to, because it's what Jesus came to accomplish. And we need God at times with the gospel, so I love to preach it, to just say to our soul, shh, take a breath. You are anxious and worried about so many things. That's what the law does. It chases us. It whips us. It condemns us. But it's good. The law is good if it's used lawfully for the purpose for which God intended it. When Paul goes on to make the argument in Romans 7:7, he says, I would not have known sin except that the law have shown it. He said, I would not have known covetousness unless the law said you should not covet. Paul's saying it has a place, and that place is to show me my sin. He's saying he wouldn't have understood what it was. And you say, but come on, that sounds a little heavy. This is a Christmas sermon. Lighten it up, Francis. Take it easy, Sparky. Right? Guys, you will never bask in the wonder of God coming in the flesh if you don't understand this. It will not gobsmack and thunder strike you like it would have a Jew unless you understand this. And the problem is we have so many people compare ourselves to that we're better than. I mean, that is a problem. You could always find someone that you're better than. You're like, babe, you're kind of critical. I mean, your cousin, right? And we have, and then we'll go to that cousin. Look at what they did in their life, as if God grades on a curve, right? Everybody gets C's. Paul says, you know, if we compare ourselves amongst ourselves, we become fools. We don't compare ourselves amongst others. We compare ourselves against his holy law. Say, I'm still not convinced. Okay. Do we got to go through this, really? All right, let's do it. You think you're a good person? Let me ask you a question. How many of the Ten Commandments do you have memorized? Rattle them off. Go ahead. Name some Ten Commandments. Some of the Ten Commandments. Give me one. Honor your father and mother. You guys done that? Perfectly? Always? Liars! I know for a fact you haven't, because you are born of the same stuff that I am. You have not always honored your mother and father without fail. Now, give me another one. Don't covet. You ever wanted something that wasn't yours? No, liar. You know you have. The success, the spouse, the whatever. Even their spirituality. Oh, I wish I loved Jesus like they did. Oh, I wish I read as much as they did. Covetous. What else? Give me another commandment. Do not kill. You're like, finally. I haven't killed anybody yet, right? And then here's the problem. You go to the New Testament where Jesus unpacks the spiritual nature of the law, and what does he say? He says, you've heard it said, you shouldn't hate your brother, but I tell you if anybody, or that you shouldn't murder, but I tell you if anyone has hated his brother without cause, he is a murderer. You ever hated someone? God says you've killed them already in your heart, assassinated them. You may not have performed the act outwardly, but your heart is a murdering heart. How about another one? Let's do another one. What's that? Oh, you're like, I haven't done that. Really? Jesus says, you should not commit adultery. But I tell you, if you've looked upon a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. Men, how you doing? I'm so glad I brought my friend here. They needed to hear this. Yeah. You shouldn't bear false witness. You shouldn't lie. Any of you ever lied? Ever? If you said no, you're lying. And how many lies do you have to tell to be a liar? 47? One. You tell one lie, it makes you a liar. You steal one thing. You take one thing that doesn't belong to you. That makes you a thief. So already we've only gone through about five, and you are an adultering, lying murderer. You see what I'm doing? I'm trying to help you understand the spiritual nature of the law that condemns us. And it's not just what we do externally. It's the attitudes and intents of our heart that's crooked and astray. And yes, even those of you that grew up in a nice, safe church little community like you have, you got the same issues. You might have been externally behaved, but inwardly, it's the same problem. And worse yet, James tells us in James 2:10, for whoever keeps the whole law but fails at one point has become guilty of all of it. What? You're like, that's overwhelming. That's the point. That is the point. It is overwhelming because the law cannot save you. That's what Jesus does. So what do we need? We need grace. And we need God's grace. And it's what sacrifices in the tabernacle were all about. They pointed forward to the true tabernacle, to the true temple, to the true and final sacrifice, who is Jesus. He is the meeting place between God and man. And in him, our sin is forgiven and our record of wrongs is punished in his flesh. And he is not only our high priest that makes atonement, he is the sacrificial lamb who is the atonement. Jesus kept the law perfectly. And it is his righteous record which makes us righteous before God. And we have access to the Father through his blood. The law can't do that. The law was never intended to do that. So why, oh, why are you trying so hard to save yourself? It's the dirty little secret in the church that no one wants to admit. We all are trying to save ourselves. That's why we're prickly over criticism. It's why we have to justify and defend ourselves, because we don't believe Christ is our justification. We don't believe Jesus is our defense. And it's why we are so judgmental of other people. It's why we look down our nose at other people. It's why I do it. I'm not telling you anything that I'm not saying to myself. It's why I do it. I judge other people because I think somehow I'm keeping the rules better than they are. So it makes us bitter and unforgiving. It's like we say things like, oh, I would never do that. Yes, you would. I heard someone tell me this last week, that they apologized to someone, and in their apology they said, I would never do that. And I knew what they were saying, but I wanted to stop and go, why? You really would never do that? I would. Like, man, if you guys could see the stuff that's in my heart that I would do, it is only the restraining grace of God that I am not in prison. Really. You say, come on, preacher, that's hyperbole. No, you don't know me. The stupid stuff, the mixed motives, the flare-ups. I'm church broken now, but it's still there. And we're all struggling in the same ways, guys. The law is not intended to save us from that. It's only grace that can do that. Because the law addresses us as members of the old covenant. Grace makes us members of new creation. The law reveals what's in us. Grace reveals what's in God, love. The law demands righteousness from us, and grace brings righteousness to us. The law condemns us to death. Grace brings us to life. The law demands what we must do. Grace reveals what Christ has done. The law gives us knowledge of sin. Grace puts away sin. And this is why John says that grace and truth came through Jesus, and the law was given through Moses. Let's look at the last passage, last verse, verse 18. He says, no one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side. Who's he talking about? Who's he talking about? Yes. He has made him known. The reason that Jesus Christ came into this world and was born of the flesh was to fulfill all that we've discussed, but ultimately, it was to reveal God to us. That's why Jesus came. Why Advent? Why Christmas? Why we celebrate? Because the Word became flesh and He revealed God to us. It's what we long for. It's what we want. We want God. We want to see God. And He's saying that no man has ever seen Him. But now, in Jesus, God is fully revealed because the Son has shown us God. And the words that He uses, has made Him known, it's actually one word in the Greek, and it means exegete. That Jesus exegetes the Father to humanity. He is the interpretive key to understand who you are and who He is and what this world is all about. Jesus exegetes God to us. He's the one who explains God to us. He's the one that shows God to us because He is the fullest revelation of God to man. And in order to know God, John is arguing, you need to know Jesus. I love that John is the one telling us this. You know why? Because he's using this language out of an overflow of what he's experienced. You know later in this story, the night that Jesus is betrayed, at the last meal, the Last Supper, when he's gathering with his disciples, you know this great and intimate and beautiful scene of the friendship that John had with his Savior Jesus, because it says that he rested in the chest of Jesus. It would be the bosom of Jesus is kind of another way of putting it. Some of you don't like that word, so we'll just say he rested on the chest of Jesus. He heard the heartbeat of God in his Savior. This is the same kind of language that John is using when he says that he is at the Father's side. It's the same intimate language. What qualifies Jesus to reveal God most fully to us is the intimate relationship that Jesus has experienced for all eternity with his Father. And to see Jesus is to know the Father. He's been at the Father's side, resting in and upon him for all eternity. And it is this Jesus that comes to tell us about the Father, to reveal to us what the Father is like. And it is out of an overflow of love, out of an overflow of glory, out of an overflow of intimate relationship that he shares what the Father is like to us. And he tells us stories of what God is like. I love that he tells the story of the prodigal in Luke 15. Why? Primarily because our minds, because we're driven by the law, think that God is like the constipated religious leaders of the day. The rule keepers. The fastidious law police. That's what we think it means to have a relationship with God. And then Jesus shows up on the scene and he goes, let me tell you a story about what Dad's like. Because I know him. And you've never seen him. I have. I know him. He's like a father who, when his son left, abandoned him and rebelled against him. He's like a father that scans the horizon looking for his son every moment of every day. And when the glimpse of his son shows up on the horizon, our father is the kind of father that ran to him, that embraced him, that received him in his heart, that said, give him the ring. He's my son. He's back. He's alive. Give him the road. Cover his filth. Give him the shoes so he can go and tell everyone that he was lost and now he's found. He was dead and now he's alive. Get the fattened calf. We're having barbecue. Jesus says, that's what Dad's like. You know what you're like? You little religious rule keeper? You're like the older brother in the field, toiling and laboring. You didn't leave the Father's side, but your heart left the Father. Because when you hear about the Dad's son coming home, your brother, you're mad at Dad. You're angry at him. You want your brother dead. Because he didn't keep the rules. And you did. Father, you never so much as gave me a goat for my friends that we might celebrate. Do you see, I've been working here all day long under the hot sun. I have never disobeyed you. I've always kept the rules. I've been out here in the field from sunrise to sunset. I've kept all the rules. And you're throwing a party for him? And the dad's like, yes, son. Son, don't you know? Everything I have is yours. All you had to do was ask. But you'd rather work. And that's why you'll never come into the party. Jesus says, that's what Dad's like. Dad's like that kind of dad. And that's why the law is not able to give us what only grace can. And that's why Jesus is perfectly qualified in this intimate relationship to reveal our Father.
Praise God for that. Well, at the end of this gospel, and I do want to end here, just reading it to you. At the end of this gospel, there's this great scene. You know, the gospel of John is pretty fast-paced. It spans over 3 years, and around 13, 14 of John's gospel, everything slows down. And between 13 and 17, it comes to a grinding halt. And those chapters focus on one night. One night. All that ink is spilled over one night. And we know that Jesus gathers his disciples and the king of the universe gets down on his knees and he lifts up his robe and he washes their feet. And he says, now you go and do the same. And he tells them about, look, love one another as I have loved you. And by this, the world's going to know you're my disciples if you have love for one another. But then you get to chapter 17, which is right before he's about to be handed over and betrayed by a friend. The chapter 17 gives us this glorious, what is called the high priestly prayer. It's what's in the heart of Jesus right before he gives up his life. If you want to know what's in the heart of someone, hear them talk before they die. Jesus knows what's coming. He knows what he's going to endure. And what's on his heart? Us. Us. That's what's on his heart. He prays for our unity. God, that they would be one as you and I, Father, are one. And he finishes his high priestly prayer with this prayer. He says in John 17, 24, Father, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be where I am to see my glory, that you have given me because you loved me before the foundation of the world, O righteous Father. Even though the world does not know you, I know you. And these know you that you have sent me. I made known to them your name, and I will continue to make it known. And he says, and here's his prayer, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them. That the love with which you have loved me, all the power of that love may be in them, and I in them. That's his prayer. That's what he wants us to experience. It's what he wants us to be sure of. He wants us to be sure of the Father's love. And he came to accomplish that very thing. And there is no other way that we can save ourselves. Merry Christmas. That's what it's all about. Let's pray.